This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com. $6 gets you in the door.
Rewind to Dynamite from the post-wrestling site. AEW lighting up the fuse. Sit back and enjoy the bubbly. We hear from John and Waitay. Where we're going, we don't need roads. And if the buck stops here, this thing might blow. Everything you hear, opinions of the show. And if you don't like it, go to the Forbes and let them know.
Here we are, everybody. It's time for the holiday bash. John Pollock, Wei Ting, what time is it?
It is exactly midnight.
It's midnight Eastern time, and that is when we are coming at you to chat about the holiday bash.
That we are, yes. Oh, mm-hmm. A little bit later than we were intending.
A lot later than intended.
Yeah.
This is a show that is, we're usually done by this point. We're starting.
Well, okay. Yes. Yes. If this was a regular Dynamite. Yeah. So this was a 3-hour show, which, you know, is a monthly occurrence at this point. And we were hoping to start at 11:15. But because Triller does this weird thing where, like, for all of these international shows that AEW does,
they can't delay. Air it in sync with the U.S. broadcast. I don't understand.
Yeah, and it's not like such a big deal that I think anybody has bothered to ask Tony Khan about it, but like it's pretty consistent. And so tonight, Triller aired this 3-hour show an hour later, which basically delayed us by, you know, however long. So, and as a result, you know, we are truncating our XL edition to just, you know, have a bit more of a snappier, quicker news portion. And that kind of gave us an excuse to just, like, make this available for free for everybody. So if you're sampling this, well, this is just a bit of a preview, I suppose, of the types of extended editions we usually do for these shows.
Yes, I'm always in this mood. You can get this in XL form every Wednesday as well.
It is the holidays. And, yeah, no, John is... Well, a John with no sleep is not always the best.
Well, I had to make some adjustments for my plans, but here we are to chat about the holiday bash. We're gonna go through a couple of news items and then we'll dive into all of the action from Manchester. But we had NXT on Tuesday night that featured a number of matches that have been set up. Mainly Leon Slater winning the Fatal 4-Way match against Dion Lennox, Miles Bourne, and Joe Hendry. So he will challenge Obafemi at New Year's Evil on January the 6th. They have also set up Chelsea Green and Sol Ruka for the episode that will air next week. And in 2 weeks' time, on the last NXT of the year, which will feature their year-end awards, they will have Ethan Page against Moose for the North American title. But the main news coming out of Tuesday's show featured the unexpected title win by Thea Hale, who became the women's, won the championship from Blake Monroe.
Yeah, yeah.
Wins the North American championship. And this was, it was very evident. You did not need to guess too much that this was not the planned finish, because Thea Hale hit this, her usual, like, springboard, senton, landed right on top of Blake and just laid on top of her. And the referee's counting 1, 2, and his arm comes down for the 3. And then Blake is certainly late, and she's trying to get her arm up. Thea Hale doesn't know what's going on. It's silent. They start playing Blake Monroe's music. They quickly cut that music. Then they play Thea Hale's music. Now, I'm going to say this one thing here. Sometimes we see it so obvious when something does not go according to plan, and there's somebody that just is reacting of our performance has been ruined. Not Thea Hale. She reacted like she had just accomplished the greatest achievement of her life, which in some ways she really did here. She celebrated. She was in tears that she had won this title. It was the most amazing reaction that she won this. And this made for quite an interesting broadcast that they had to put in a whole new, they shot stuff for social media. They did a segment later with Blake Monroe confronting Thea Hale. they basically did like this impromptu, like Jordan Grace coming in and having to react to Thea Hale winning the title. So I am sure that this is a total nightmare logistically because they're taping all of their TV this week. But this was like a cool moment that happened, and it is going to force them to have to run with this change rather than, you know, if this had been one of their taped shows this week, they would have just redone the finish. But this was live, and they decided, hey, we got to make a snap decision. Let's just go with what everyone saw, which was a three count.
It was certainly the most interesting thing coming out of the show. And for something like the North American Championship, which even in the World Championship, honestly, like, you know, for it's NXT, it's your developmental brand. I don't think you're really losing that much by having to shift plans on the fly like this. In wrestling, it's one of those really interesting, you know, occurrences where storylines can change off of something as simple as somebody being a fraction of a second late, getting their shoulder to twitch properly. And by all accounts, it seemed like, you know, Blake Monroe actually had like the wind knocked out of her that might have prevented, you know, her from actually giving a full kick out. And these things are going to happen. It's almost a surprise that it doesn't happen more in live professional wrestling. So I don't necessarily think this is something you can blame her for. In fact, it's a chance for us to see how somebody like a Thea Hale would react under this sort of like, you know, unexpected situation. And I thought she did relatively well. Listen, like, I don't think she's the greatest actress in the world. Certainly, but on the fly, you maybe have to certainly give everybody involved some credit. I would actually give the referee a whole lot of credit. I mean, on commentary, like Booker was certainly having his way with.
Oh, he just ripped this guy apart. These junior referees. But these guys, if they are in fact told to count it like a shoot, like that's what he did. Like,
so
it's,
you remember the Nia Jax, Tiffany Stratton, like, I mean, there are numerous occasions, like, you know, that something like this has happened. And it's always super awkward, even more awkward when a ref holds up the count despite the shoulder being down. I don't think I think this ref should actually be commended for the way they reacted, knowing that there's probably tremendous pressure on him, knowing all the dominoes that were about to fall after this title change and the sort of a headache that it would cause. Apparently, like, you know, like certain things were shot already, assuming that Blake Monroe was going to be champion. They had to basically change all of that. This referee, in a split second, had to make that decision, and I think he made the right one, ultimately.
Listen, if that is what they're told to do, then when something like this happens, the referee is not the one that is, you know, to blame in a situation like this. And if this causes that many problems, then you tell the referee, hey, this is the finish, and you're not to call it like a shoot. But that's always what I've been heard is like has been like that. That's what he did here. And sometimes, you know, this wasn't what was planned, but it's something that you can run with. And, you know, it made for an interesting story on Tuesday, just the whole circumstance of it and how they pivot from this.
Yeah, certainly. I'll be like, it's one of the more exciting things about this style of storytelling, the fact that it's written live and can change live depending on something so small. So this is actually, in fact, made things a lot more intriguing.
So Tokyo Sports put out its annual year-end awards, and for the first time ever, Saya Kamatani, the first female recipient of the MVP award, is the winner this year. She had the entire year, she was the World of Stardom champion, had those two incredible matches with Tam Nakano, including retiring her back in April. And I mean, she did a lot between the title defenses. She had a title defense on TBS, which was the first time a women's match has aired on like terrestrial television since like 2002. And she's been like the focal point of Stardom all year. But I mean, the Tokyo Sports Awards, like, they are very political, and I think that this was, you know, you can look at the credentials of what, like, they, I'm not going to say these are like you know, like kayfabe awards, but in some ways they are. There's, it's kind of like a mix of all of this where it's combining like what you have done versus your importance. Typically, it's like every promotion is going to have some representation here, but I was certainly surprised that they, you know, put like a female in this spot. And you could certainly make the argument this year of like top performers in Japan that like were on the top of their companies this year. Like, who is the, like, Konosuke Takeshita, I believe, finished second in the balloting. And it's like his New Japan run was really limited to the G1 this year. Like, that's basically been his involvement. Like, he has not been a full-time performer there. If Goto had held the title all year, maybe he would have gotten it. But you did not have your franchise player. In fact, like, I thought if Ozawa had not gotten hurt, he might have been the guy, because he was a major figure for Noah this year, but he was hurt for a good portion of it.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting. You know, certainly as somebody who is only sort of absorbing, let's say, non-New Japan, you know, news via, you know, like maybe yourself, certainly WH and Bruce and Karen, you know, and just like the general sort of discussion, rather than actively watching a lot of these shows, like, I can't really say there are many breakout sort of names that are out there. You know, so much of, I think, that concentration has sort of moved over to AEW, it's just more so the fact that, like, the North American, you know, offerings from the big two are already so abundant that really the appetite for a Westerner, for a Japanese wrestling-based promotion, is way less than it was many years ago. That all said, though, this Taya Kamatani Tam Nakano feud, primarily, you know, like, to me at least, you know, really managed to make some waves. And, you know, on these year end lists that are coming up, I imagine that particular retirement match may still at this point make a lot of people's lists. So I think this says a whole lot about, you know, like, her incredible evolution into this heel character. I think it says a lot, maybe just about, like, the current Japanese wrestling scene when it comes to the men. This is, of course, not taking anything away from Saya Kamatani, but the fact that, like, currently in New Japan, you don't have that massive star that's breaking out. And really in these other promotions, maybe just not the attention grabbing sort of platforms, you know, that are offered either. So something like this makes a whole lot of sense to me, and probably a long time coming.
Best match went to Kaito Kiyomiya and Ozawa from Noah's The New Year event back on January the 1st. Best tag team, Oscar and Yuto Ice.
All right.
Yuto Ice getting that plaque. Outstanding performance for the year. That went to Konosuke Takeshita, which kind of is like your runner-up to MVP. So that was his consolation prize. Fighting Spirit went to Sare, who had another phenomenal year, both as a wrestler, a promoter, the ability she can work for Marigold, for Stardom. Best technique, Hiroshi Tanahashi. Best technique.
How do you define technique, I guess?
You see how he plays those strings on the air guitar.
Do they mean like is this a kayfabe thing? And like, what is that exactly does this mean?
I mean, if I'm looking at like best technical, it is not Hiroshi Tanahashi.
Right.
I mean, man shows a lot of heart in his babyface comebacks, but I don't know. He is getting like your, this is his final year and he's being awarded by Tokyo Sports so that he is featured among the class of the year.
Wouldn't that be more outstanding performance or fighting spirit? You know,
well, they have to, Takeshita had to get something as like the top. He is the IWGP champion. So the this is where I talk about like the kind of the political aspect to these awards that get a lot of attention in Japan. Rookie of the year, Kaisei Takechi, the influencer turned DDT competitor set for the Wrestle Kingdom. I guess this constituted his rookie year, even though like he wrestled multiple matches in 2024, but he had five matches this year. And he wins the rookie award. But he probably has more notoriety than anyone else on this list. So that probably helps his cause. And the Women's Pro Wrestling Award kind of had to go to Saya Kamatani, you would think.
Sure.
That would be tough to have her become MVP, but she loses out on the Women's Pro Wrestling Award.
Well, somebody could be an incredible draw, but maybe not be the greatest pro wrestler, maybe.
Well, an interesting set of awards, as always, from Tokyo Sports. Mick Foley, not a voter for the Tokyo Sports Awards, but he made his voice heard this week. The man has he has seen a lot happen in the WWE over the ensuing years, but his last stand occurred with Donald Trump's horrendous comments about the deaths of Rob and Michelle Reiner. And so he has announced just the other night that he has informed WWE talent relations that he will no longer be making any appearances for the company as long as Donald Trump remains in office, and because of WWE's ties to the office. And he says that he will also not be renewing his Legends deal once it expires in June. He says, I love WWE, will always treasure my time with them, and I'm deeply appreciative for all the opportunities they afforded me, while quoting Popeye. A fitting quote to end things off here. Does it surprise you at all that maybe not so much that if you were to guess of somebody that would actually put some kind of action into their beliefs, that it would be Mick Foley, but the fact that it was this particular incident that was enough for Mick Foley to go to this extent? And granted, I don't know like the significance of like what his Legends deal is paying him, but it's something. It is something that he is opting to forego and at least cast a temporary distance from WWE, which this guy has had his separations with WWE over the decades.
Right. Yeah. Does it surprise me that maybe like this particular incident was the straw that broke the camel's back? Maybe in a way, yes, because like honestly, like I was just as horrified as anybody in reading Trump's truth, whatever you want to call it, post about that. But I also like at this point kind of feel like it's just one of many offenses that I'm sadly getting numb to with this man. But you know, that said, it's taken really, I would say, like a different life, at least in the mainstream. You know, a lot of people seem to be a lot more affected by this particular incident.
And more so people in the Republican Party that have also pushed back against this. Like, not to say that there are those that have opted just to ignore it. Do you think that this changes at all if, in fact, you know, if for whatever reason Donald Trump had actually gone there on Saturday night, and then this comes out on he posts that on Monday, and there's just recently this big appearance by Donald Trump. He's probably promoted as, you know, President of the United States, WWE Hall of Famer. He's going to be doing his photos with Paul Levesque and such, where it would be more fresh, the connection to WWE. It's not like anyone would have been calling on a Mick Foley or anyone to speak up about this specific issue. I don't think many people look at the link of Donald Trump to WWE as opposed to the other organism of TKO.
Sure. Yeah. You mean would it be different? Like, would I have expected Foley to take action?
I'd just say more so just in terms of WWE, just they would wrap their arms around Donald Trump on Saturday, and then he goes out and does this on Monday, that link is so fresh with WWE, for instance. Like, he does this highly publicized appearance, and then this is the guy that WWE is celebrating. I think the fan base would have a lot more outrage over that.
Perhaps, yeah. Yeah, perhaps. I also wonder, like, how much WWE... Like, okay, let's assume Trump, like, did show up on Saturday. How much they would publicize it? And I don't, like, knowing them, yes, if the president shows up to a wrestling event, they're probably going to show it and they're probably going to let people know about it. But they didn't do a thing to mention RFK Jr.'s appearance. You know, he was
there's like, a big difference, though, between those two.
But still somebody like who's incredibly powerful, you know, somebody who's like, you know, like a political figure that everybody would know. I mean,
Trump also isn't going to that event. Unless it's going to be very well known that he is there. Like, he is not there to just be in the background either.
It would definitely be, require WWE to actively draw a line in the sand in a way that they hadn't prior on their active television. Like, all the things we've seen with Levesque, you know, doing, that's, you might consider extracurricular or, like, something that's not necessarily reflected on TV. Trump appearing and then like profiling him and showcasing him, I think would be like, you know, them basically saying, okay,
it would be crossing a line that WWE has been very careful on its air not to cross. Like, politically, I mean, like even the Paul Levesque connection, I mean, you can very much look at that what this guy is doing. Yes, he's on the president's council. He's not attached to like a political agenda in the sense that this is about trying to get young people to work out and get it, like that's not a very divisive issue that Paul Levesque is attaching himself with. It's the administration that he is a part of that you can have your qualms with, but the issue itself that he, you know, this is not a guy that is out there going on ICE raids and supporting that sense of things.
No, no.
It's not and like we're getting recruitment ads, which the UFC is more than happy to run on their television or pay-per-views.
Well, I mean, AEW as well, but there was that's not their choice, to our knowledge. But I think this story is significant because, you know, you have somebody who is a significant figure in the industry directly pointing out calling out the ties between WWE and Donald Trump and this administration, at least, you know, to the level that it's problematic for him. And so I think that's pretty significant. You know, a lot of people, I've seen zero criticism really from either side over Mick Foley's decision to do this. And
I've seen some like where it was like, you know, why is he leaving now after all the things that have happened? And it's like, you can have whatever opinion you want, but again, we talk a lot about, you know, performers in this industry that are just so afraid to shake any bit of authority, of any power. It's like, here is one of the very few that's opting to do something that comes at no benefit to him. There is not, he could easily have just stomached this, continued to cash his action figure royalties, whatever his Legends deal pays. He's on a good relationship with WWE, but he chose to do something. And I think if you jump on top of someone like this, it only tells the next person that, like, forget this. I'm not going to rock the boat here because not only am I jeopardizing my spot taking a stand, but I'm going to be criticized because I didn't do it on someone else's timetable. I think it's very rare we see someone just opt to say, you know what, I don't want to be attached to this because of my own ethical reasons. And I don't think, like, there should be any kind of, you know, moral disdain for someone making this choice that really comes at no benefit to them other than, like, it's like clearing his own conscience that he just does not want this affiliation.
Yeah. And I'm sure he, Mick Foley at this point, he's not an active professional wrestler. I would say he doesn't have that much power in the industry or influence in the industry. What he does have is this Legends deal. And I think his, willingness to sever that is the most he can exercise his power to tell the world that, hey, this isn't right and I can't stand by it and this is what I can do about it.
And has a few examples, like when he was an active performer doing this type of thing, like when, like the screw job, like he was willing to, like he walked out. He didn't show up to TV the next day over it. That's how disgusted he was by it. And, you know, it was Brett who told him, like, go back to work. Like, and, you know, look at his 1998 and 1999 that he had. And here was someone in November of 97 that was willing to, like, walk out of the company over that. So, I mean, you can have whatever thoughts you have. And certainly, like, Mick Foley, like, he has been, you know, even when pressed, like, he is not going to disparage Vince McMahon. He holds Vince McMahon in very high regard and has spoken as such. But, we will see if there. This did get, like, attention because of who it was. Like, NBC did a story on this, and it did get some attention. Last bit of news here. Penta is off of this Saturday's AAA Guerra de Titanes event that's happening in Guadalajara. So they were going to be promoting the main event around the Lucha Brothers together. And instead, with Penta's shoulder injury that he sustained on Raw a few weeks ago, it will now be Rey Mysterio, who is teaming with Rey Fénix, taking on Dominic Mysterio and El Grande Americano in the main event. This is like a 20,000 seat building, and the heat for this is going to be off the chart on Saturday night. They're streaming this on their WWE YouTube channel, so you will be able to watch it for free. It's also got El Hijo de Dr. Wagner Jr. defending the Latin American title against Ethan Page, a three-way match for the Cruiserweight title with Laredo Kid, Jack Cartwheel, and Javon Evans. That sounds great. Rayo and Bravo of Los Americanos taking on Mr. Iguana and Nino Hamburguesa, the LWO of Cruz del Toro and Joaquin Wilde, and Octagon Jr. and La Parca. Singles match between Dragon Lee and El Hijo del Vikingo. The Wyatt Six against Pagano, Psycho Clown, Murder Clown, and Dave the Clown in a Carnival of Carnage 8-man tag. And in a women's trios match, Maravilla, La Hiedra, and Flamer against Natalia, Lola Vice, and Fabi Apache. So that looks like a really great card, and I think the atmosphere is going to be amazing for this show on Saturday night. And I mean, you can certainly say WWE, they are more than making up for the loss of Penta by giving them probably the most valuable piece of lucha talent that they can provide for a show like this as a last minute replacement.
It's an incredible make good. Yeah.
And the last note we'll make is Cain Velasquez. It was listed on the California Incarcerated Records and Information Search that he is now eligible for parole in February, which is 1 month ahead of what the initial term had been. He was given a 5-year prison sentence last year. He was sentenced this past March, but he was credited with time served, both in county jail and under house arrest, of course, for the attempted murder charge that he faced with the 2022 car chase where he was attempting to kill Harry Goularte Jr., who was in the vehicle that Cain Velasquez shot at but missed him and hit the Harry Goularte's stepfather. This after Goularte Jr. was allegedly had sexually assaulted Velasquez's son. So, I mean, he could be paroled as early as February for him. So that's going to be an interesting one to see if he ends up paroled or not. It's been a very quiet on the Cain Velasquez front as he's just been quietly serving his time over this last 9 months or so.
Yeah. If not February, it was going to be March anyway. So a month.
Yeah. And he's just eligible. It's not a guarantee he will get out, but you know, there was a lot of support for Cain Velasquez. We will see what happens in February. All right, everybody. You can always catch the news at postwrestling.com. Jack Wannon, Neil Flanagan, John Kleinchester, everyone keeping you up to date on what's going on. John Kleinchester was manning the site tonight for the Holiday Bash, which we are going to be getting to momentarily. But we do want to alert everyone that Way and I, as late as we go tonight, we will be back on Thursday. And we're going all the way back to 2002. It is the WWF Draft. The inaugural draft. It was, hey, we messed up the invasion. Let's try again. Don't let these pesky secondary brands get in the way. We're going to do Raw and SmackDown. That's what was missing in 2001. So we got Vince McMahon and Ric Flair making their choices. And what a roster the two would accumulate over the course of this 2-hour edition of Raw.
It'll be a discussion about, you know, certainly 2002 WWE, which I actually have very deep memory of, so I'm looking forward to the conversation. But it'll also be a conversation about maybe the most the ideals of what a brand split was going to be, you know, at a time when you can argue they took this the most seriously day one, and then from that point on it was all downhill. So yeah, we'll see. Yeah,
yes, find out who is drafted first, who's got a exemption clause in their contract because they've gone home. So much to get to on the 2002 draft. That's coming out Thursday for all members at postwrestlingcafe.com. Way, we are going to Manchester, England at the Co-op Live. 10,815 tickets distributed. One of the best crowds of the year for AEW and at least their biggest non-pay-per-view crowd since Grand Slam Australia back in February. So, nearly 11,000 people, and they came to watch wrestling, and they got plenty of it. Not just this 3-hour show, but then the 1-hour version of Collision that's going to air on Saturday afternoon, they got taped as well. So they got like 4 hours of wrestling on this show, and they sounded very lively by the end of this 3-hour broadcast.
I felt the energy dip a little towards the end, but maybe that was just me.
I mean, they were singing for Juice Robinson, like,
yeah, that's true.
Juice, there it is. I mean, they were trying. They were still workshopping more chants. But we go way back to the beginning of this show at Jon Moxley and Roderick Strong in the Blue League, where both men are facing elimination with a loss, and they would fight into the crowd. Moxley tries for a Gotch pile driver, but Strong dumps him outside. They end up on the steps where Moxley gets slammed on top of them. He's holding the shoulder, takes a tiger driver for a 2 count, and then Strong leaps into this cutter that he gets caught with in midair, hit with a pile driver, and then an RNC is applied onto Roderick, and he rolls to the rope. This was so funny. It was like, this is just right out of Gunther and Cena, and Roderick just powers his way all the way across the ring to the rope and gets out. Never give up, Roderick Strong. And then he gets the stronghold, and again, I will repeat this. Moxley, I think, has made his matches now where every submission is going to be a tease that the crowd is going to buy into. like forever. I think people are going to buy these submission teases, even with a Roderick Strong. But Strong then adjusts. Moxley kicks him off. Paradigm shift and a Death Rider for good measure, pinning Roderick in 18 minutes and 11 seconds, and Moxley moves to 6 points. Roderick Strong is out of the Continental Classic.
Yes, yeah. A very good match. I will say, though, I thought maybe I didn't necessarily think this one deserved to go 18 minutes. To me, that was a little bit long considering how irrelevant Strong is as a character on the show.
Are you aware of the runtime of the show, Way?
Yes, I am. And that was maybe more of the reason why I felt like, you know, this pace wasn't necessarily the best for a match that wasn't maybe didn't have that much interest going into it to start off the entire thing. I think the narrative through line of both men trying to avoid elimination is very good, but I feel like it could have been emphasized a little bit stronger through the supplementary material, of which there really was not much at all, save for that Renee voice note. So, but I mean, certainly what stood out in this crowd was, which I love, by the way, I love those Renee, like sort of like check-ins, you know, to give us a little bit of extra context. I mean, that sort of information could be given just as easily by Excalibur, but by having a different voice attached to it, it kind of perks up your attention a little bit more and gives us more of a sports-like presentation, which I think, you know, the C2 was always aiming for. What stood out tonight certainly is just how much maybe Roderick Strong is beloved in front of these particular crowds, and many particular crowds, but especially one that contains, I think, a lot of people that probably have seen a lot of his work over the years. So at least showing in parts of the world that he's still capable of being pushed into a bigger role.
Yeah, I like this match a lot. I enjoyed it in the opening role. I thought that Roderick, I think a lot of the, especially the stronghold towards the end, like they had a great crowd, and I think they really bit for the submissions. And you can see Moxley, like he's really working. Like you could really see this babyface version of Jon Moxley coming through, and that is emphasized more with this promo later. It's the most babyface promo you're going to hear from Jon Moxley. Maybe part of the reason I really enjoyed this was the first half of this match I listened to in Spanish, which the commentary was fantastic because Triller also had their languages mixed on different channels. But the Spanish feed was not that bad. I was not upset thinking that I might have to watch the whole show in Spanish.
Maybe a worthy experiment from time to time.
The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Throughout the month of January, you have the chance to lock in your subscription at the Post Wrestling Cafe for all of 2026 before the price increase takes effect February the 1st. Simply sign up before February 1st and you will lock in that price all year long. If that's not enough, this month we have the annual Best and Worst Of show as we get together with the Poison Rana crew to look back at 2025. We're also doing live watch-alongs of the Royal Rumbles from 1990 and 1995 with Brandon from New Jersey, a retrospective on the Tanahashi-Okada rivalry, plus reaction to Wrestle Kingdom 20, a review of TNA's debut on AMC, and much more, including TNA Genesis, UFC 324. It's all found at postwrestlingcafe.com. Eddie Kingston, you either win or you learn. You never lose. Man's been reading John Kavanaugh, and he warns his future opponents, I never stop, I never quit, this is all I've got in my life, and maybe I'm going to show up on Collision. Spoiler, he will show up on Collision. Kazuchika Okada, Konosuke Takeshita, and Hechicero against the Young Bucks and Kenny Omega fighting for $1 million. Or is what'd they say, 750,000 pounds?
I don't know.
Okay, something in that neighborhood. The Bucks came out to their old elite music, and we have Takeshita working alongside Hechicero. They high-five while Okada just looks at them in disgust. And the Bucks ended up taking them out with triple dives. And we go through multiple picture in pictures in this match. Nick gets tagged. He went in this sequence that started with a Greco-Roman knuckle lock into a flying head scissors, then a Rana off the apron, and then into the ring, charges at Takeshita with a cutter. And then they just polish him off with the Risky Business. This guy is just, he's something else to watch. He just flows just from one spot to the next, one guy to the next. And it was just incredible. I rewound this to watch. It was just a thing of beauty here. Then he turns a mad scientist bomb by Hechicero into a Canadian destroyer. Builds up to Okada and Omega being tagged in, and Omega ducks a Rainmaker. And then we get a V-trigger to Takeshita. Everyone's down. Indy Taker gets stopped with Okada's dropkick to Matt. And then Okada nearly hits Takeshita with the Rainmaker after a duck. And they shove one another. Omega's in with snapdragons to all of them. And Hechicero is left by his lonesome. Triple super kick by the Elite. V-trigger. And then an assisted one-winged angel with the Bucks working kind of like an Indy Taker into it for the win in 22 minutes and 32 seconds.
Great match. I thought the match more than delivered on the standard that you've come to expect from these multi-person matches involving the Bucks. Creative multi-man spots, incredible speed and coordination. And, you know, for me, almost a little bit heartwarming to see Kenny and the Bucks team together again. I don't even remember when the last time it was. I mean, maybe not too far in the past, but still, after all that we've seen through Kenny, I this was kind of heartwarming to see. And you know,
if we're going to put Kenny in like multi-mans to alleviate some of the necessity for him to do all these big singles matches, we could do one of these a month.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, we know Kenny, his physical abilities are likely limited because of his infrequent performing schedule. But in the times when we actually get to see him in the ring, he still wrestles like the same Kenny Omega that we have, you know, like the image that we have of him in our minds. So it tells me that, like, in trying to keep that up, it probably really takes a toll on him. And so I think it makes me appreciate even a trios match like this a whole lot more, because who knows how long we'll be able to even get to see something like this. So I thought they overall gave us some very good spotlight as well, storytelling wise on Okada Takeshita, which is the big one coming out of this. Thought they provided some pretty good tension for the two of them in Okada Omega, you know, continuing to profile that interaction, even though I don't think that's building to anything, but continuing to profile it as this sort of legendary meeting by giving it the appropriate spotlight within the match like this, I thought was very strong. So yeah, you should probably watch this one, everybody.
Excellent, excellent match. So after the match, there's a Rainmaker delivered, and Takeshita and Okada work together with a Raging Fire Rainmaker combos to each of the Bucks, and then they switch and deliver the move to the other brother. And it ends with Takeshita and Okada shoving one another, and Omega returns to the ring and sends them out with a broom.
Mm-hmm.
The cleaners got this.
Yep.
Yep. Shivani is out for the contract signing with Samoa Joe, Hangman, and Swerve. So Joe is the first to sign. Swerve explains how he was always coming back for the AEW title, regardless of who held it, including Paige. But we do have mutual respect. And he reminds Joe, I took your title last time, and I'm going to swerve stomp you so badly, your face will be uglier than when you had that tattoo on your face.
This got a good reaction.
That's quite a deep cut that this Manchester crowd was on top of.
I mean, if you're going to, you know, do a callback line like that, I think the UK is always a good choice. There's some very long time diehard wrestling fans.
That's where you put out your deep material.
Yeah.
Paige reminds the three of them that they were all fighting together this past summer against the Death Riders, and it could have been any of us that won the title. It ended up being me. And Joe, you failed at Wrestle Dream, so you had to turn to others, including Hook. And I would hate for the legend of Samoa Joe to be remembered for the piece of shit you are today. And I wanted to defend it against all of you guys. I wanted to defend it against Darby, against Ospreay, which the crowd loved that. And I knew eventually I would be across the ring from Swerve. He says he doesn't know who will be champion after World's End, but he guarantees Joe will not be the champion. And as they all sign the contract, the lights go out, and the return of MJF. He's not coming back for a ring. He's coming back for the belt. Huge reaction. And
this was a very interesting choice because, I mean, I think, you know, at the start of the show, knowing the Diamond Ring Battle Royal was taking place, everybody pretty much expected MJF to show up, but not like this, not in a completely different thing from the Diamond Ring Battle Royal.
It was a swerve.
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm.
Didn't deliver him in the way you thought, but you did get MJF on this show that many had thought would be coming back. So Mark Sterling is at ringside and hands him the contract. He signs it, and Tony Schiavone informs us that he is cashing in his casino gauntlet shot that he won back at All In Texas, and it is now a four-way at World's End.
I almost totally forgot that this thing was still in play.
Yeah, That was kind of the tricky part about bringing him back for this Dynamite. Like, yes, he's associated with the ring, but he's already got a title shot. He'd be just like, you know, just stocking up these title matches for the new year. So then MJF is going to explain all of this. He says he's entering. Why am I coming back to take on three guys for the title? Well, Paige, you called me a coward, and winning it this way against all these people you respect and doing it this way will cut you much deeper. And he mocks Samoa Joe. He says that Joe was the one that beat him for the title and says, I don't want to be an all-time great. I need to be an all-time great. And now it's going to be the role reversal. I'm going to end your title reign in the same place where you ended mine in Chicago. Then he moves on to Swerve, comparing him to P. Diddy. And he says that the two of us, we grinded on the indies. I came here to become the greatest homegrown star while he stares right at Hangman. While you went to WWE, and this gets a negative reaction, and MJF, it's a great place. It's a great place. But I did enjoy, you didn't have a great time there, but I did enjoy you twerking for Top Dollar. And then you came knocking on my door and said, you're a messy tenant. This is my house and the rent's due. And the devil has come to collect. I'm Michael Corleone, and I'm going to handle all my family business in one night at World's End. I thought this promo was among MJF's finest. I am sure you can pick out some of like the origin story MJF ones when he had the punk feud. This would be in select company. This guy came in, and my God, he felt like the biggest star of these four, and just person by person, I thought this was just an excellent, excellent promo to set this four-way up.
Oh, he was tremendous. Yeah. I thought like
this version of MJF felt like he has something that he was missing a lot of last year. It was just something that was not all there with the MJF presentation that this to me had.
Yeah, maybe it was like being involved in the top mix, you know, maybe it was being involved in like the A guys in the company, perhaps. But it certainly brought that out of him. I thought all three challengers did well in this segment preceding even the MJF conversation. I thought
these are all your top guys in this match, basically, that are not hurt.
I thought Swerve showed some great fire, had a great line about the face tattoo, and I think he did a good job reminding everybody of his particular history with Joe, being the one that beat Joe for the title the last time. Paige, I thought, sounded really good. You know, he was able to tie all of this back to All In, where the three of them, Joe, Paige, and Swerve, all worked together to beat the Death Riders. And I loved him saying that that spot could have been yours, Joe. That spot could have been yours, Swerve. But instead, you know, I was the hero because you guys couldn't get your shit together, or we couldn't get our shit together, but we could with me. And I like, essentially, he's saying that I was the chosen one and you guys weren't. They all did well. But then MJF came out, and I would say like that was almost like, you know, at this sort of like eight level, MJF, rest in peace, Rod Ryder, took things to 11 here with what his material had entailed. And I kind of feel like he eviscerated all of them in a way that was like tremendously entertaining and captivating. But I have to say, also in a way that I think robbed a lot of the coolness from some of your guys in this mix. And that's primarily Joe and Swerve. Joe, to me, is somebody who I think has developed a great aura of being like a final boss type of character. and to see somebody stand next to him, stand up to him, shout in his face, and making fun of his hairline. I think, so listen, it's a great first round. It all necessitated some comeback, you know, some ability to hear what a Joe would be able to say in retaliation. And he might get that in future weeks, but it's just not going to really hit the same with a week removed. I think my bigger problem, though, is with Swerve, because while tremendously entertaining, the Diddy line caught on with this crowd, and they were chanting Diddy. They were calling Swerve Diddy.
It's totally fucked.
You know, like, that's, I mean, it's, it was so funny, and I loved it, of course, but I also think it unnecessarily maybe made MJF the babyface in this and kind of took some of that away from Swerve, and in fact kind of made Swerve a little bit less cool here, you know? Listen, it all could have been alleviated with a second round comeback, or at least just one or two lines from Swerve or Joe in retaliation, just to kind of retain it. But the segment wasn't necessarily designed for that. It was like, you know, to have a big impactful MJF segment coming out here. Certainly had a big mic drop sort of like feel attached to it. And I really liked it overall. Really, really liked it. But I think Swerve and Joe have to come back really, really strong, you know, in order to maybe overcome some of this.
I mean, I get that. I think this was mainly about, like, this segment is, we've already promoted this big three-way. This, yes, we have the surprise return, but this segment has to justify why MJF is in this match. So I think that, and you should get, you know, some, like, final segments before the pay-per-view. But I felt by the end of this, it's like, you've upped the star power. I feel like this is a really big main event for AEW. Going into their final pay-per-view of the year. And I think you added to that with the, what was a really great promo, and what, like, you're pretty much like with an Ospreay out, like, you're putting all your big guns into this match. And I'm more so interested in, like, what this, you know, AEW's pay-per-views since going to HBO Max, like, they've held up really well. And I'm curious to see what this pay-per-view with, like, a big main event like this, plus the culmination of a month of your booking with the Continental Classic, like, if that takes them above their kind of normal level that they are doing.
I like the addition of MJF a lot. I think it injects, again, a lot more heat, you know, to all of this, because you have somebody who, you know, like, has certainly took things to another level in terms of just like personal grudge and rivalry. So they have, you know, like some awkward taping schedules ahead. You know, they're taping basically the rest of next week on over the weekend in the Hammerstein Ballroom. So,
and these shows are running on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm curious to see like how much they can elevate this that much more. I think this certainly demands more mic, you know, back and forth interactions between all of them. So I hope they can fit that in.
In many ways, this is kind of the default go home show, because these next, this Saturday and then Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, I'm sorry, like, there's going to be a lot less focus on these programs, the leading into the pay-per-view. Like, this is your big show before the pay-per-view.
I would even suggest, like, it might necessitate more, like, online building, you know, through social media, through the work of
the,
like,
Swerve need to drop a video.
A diss track, maybe.
Yeah, maybe Hangman could do one, too. Yeah. Speedball and Kevin Knight. Yeah, I'm sorry, but we went from this, like, this 10-minute tour de force of MJF to Speedball. The Continental Classic is progressing nicely, and he is with Kevin Knight, and they react to their match that they had over the weekend, and Bayley says he's coming off the two biggest wins of his career. And on Collision, it's Bayley against Jack Perry and Kevin Knight against Kazuchika Okada.
So they've done a great job over the past week of, I mean, giving Bayley like two incredible performances and like two really strong wins. But and I thought this segment was a great way to remind and to check in with Jetspeed, who you can argue are like some of the tournament's like most consistent highlights. You know, in some ways they're kind of stealing the tournament. But man, like, these two couldn't sound more different as personalities. I don't doubt that they're actual friends, but it's just I would say they haven't exactly figured out their chemistry on the microphone yet between the two of them.
This is not, it's only out of respect. Of course, I would never think that of you any other way. We are Jetspeed.
Yeah. This is a rap video right here.
It is. Yeah. Look at this. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of what it would be called. Timeless Love Bombs and the Babes of Wrath against Mercedes Moné, Athena, Marina Shafir, and Megan Bain. So Harley got destroyed for like the first half of this match, and it led to the tag to Tony. As always, they go wild for Tony. Athena stops the Storm Zero that was about to be delivered to Shafir, and then Willow's in. Bain hits a Frankensteiner off of the turnbuckle, and it's Athena diving to the floor. Moné teases one, but is stopped with a pounce from Willow. Willow comes off the apron with a cannonball, and then Willow returns to the ring and gets caught with the O-face by Athena, as Mercedes is the legal woman, pinning her in 9 minutes and 25 seconds. And as you would have thought from this finish, this sets up the tag title match for World's End. It will be Mercedes and Athena going for the tag belts as the first challengers for the Babes of Wrath. And so for that reason, this finish made a lot of sense, and it gets, you know, I'm looking forward to this match.
It's a big match. Yeah. I think certainly pay-per-view worthy, and potentially a big win for the Babes of Wrath, you know, to continue to establish them. Although, of course, they could always do the title change, but I don't really see it so soon.
I mean, Mercedes did drop a few belts, so maybe she could pick up some hardware here. It's always possible.
It's possible, but I think she continues to lose those belts.
Pac and Kyle Fletcher in the Gold League. Pac has 3 points, Kyle Fletcher, 6. And there was this... These two murdered each other with this double clothesline spot as they're coming back from picture-in-picture. Pac gets caught in a Michinoku driver as he comes off the ropes, then delivers a belly-to-belly, sending Fletcher into the corner, follows with an Orihara moonsault. These two were just going full out. And then Pac avoids the brainbuster. Springboard is caught by Kyle, who then gets caught in a standing brutalizer. He's taken down to the mat, but Kyle gets to the rope. Fletcher kicks Pac off balance from the top turnbuckle, hits his running boot and the brainbuster. And I think everyone thought this was the finish. So when Pac kicked out, this whole place went nuts. And then Pac sets up Fletcher onto the turnbuckle and he hits him with a poison Rana off the turnbuckle, setting up the Black Arrow. And this was an incredible finish. 14 minutes, 58 seconds, creating a tie between Okada, Bailey, Pac, and Fletcher, all with 6 points coming out of this. And the Kyle Fletcher run continues in this tournament because this was another excellent match.
Incredible. Great match. Super athletic, hard-hitting, great
precision.
This
is the most Pac has done since he's gotten back. Like, he was, you know,
sure,
he's very selective now with, like, his big, like, flying spots. But this sequence was as ambitious as he's gotten.
He was essentially a babyface here, wrestling in England, right?
And the crowd was reacting like they were behind him in this match, too.
Yeah, so it was kind of nice to see this side of Pac again, at least for one night. And just kind of continues to bolster the Continental Classic as, like, a tournament where you really should check out every single match.
Should he have worn the Neville cape just for old time's sake?
Old time's sake.
Just to come out.
Yes, yes.
Does that not quite fit this version? The Dynamite Diamond Battle Royal. So we have a Brodito, who get jumped by Ricochet and GOA on the way to their ring, but they're all in this, along with Ace Austin, Max Caster, Anthony Bowens, Mark Davis, Josh Alexander, Luchasaurus, and Shelton Benjamin. Tell me the winner is getting a title shot on TV without telling me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is quite the lineup here. So it's just funny that we are watching these men kill each other all month for the Continental title, this leg of the title. And these guys are all going for a world championship shot next month.
Well, listen.
This is the road less traveled. I would have gone for this.
I've never liked that about the Continental Classic. I think it's the most grueling and therefore most prestigious tournament in the company. It really should be positioned at a time in the calendar where it should take the place of the Owen as the thing that grants somebody a title shot at All In, at the big show of the year, you know? It's the hardest one, way harder than I think the Owen is. So
we got Bowens and Caster again teasing their reunion. They did a scissor me timbers, and they were about to scissor when Ricochet cuts them off and tosses Caster out. I like that spot. We got a bunch, just a procession of eliminations here. Luchasaurus and Shelton briefly worked together. They were kind of the powerhouses in this match. There's an ankle lock that Josh Alexander applies to Brody King, but he counters by sending Josh toward Bandido, who monkey flips him over the top, probably the best elimination of the bunch. Brodito and Ricochet are left. Brodito, Ricochet, and Gates of Agony are the ones left remaining. Brody kills Toa. They both go over the top to the floor. And then a Poison Rana by Bandido sends Khan out, meaning we will get Bandido against Ricochet at the Hammerstein Ballroom this weekend, which will air next Wednesday. So if you don't have plans on Christmas Eve, you'll at least get a pretty phenomenal match in front of a hot Manhattan crowd next week.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I wonder if this crowd was a bit disappointed that they aren't working.
It's such a letdown finish when you're doing it this way, which you're just, it's unsatisfying because you don't have like a winner. And it's also a phenomenal match that you're also not getting.
So, I mean, they did inform people.
There was no bait and switch here. This is exactly as it was outlined. But in the moment, if you're this crowd, like, you want to see this.
But it was informed in like a very blink and you miss it type of way from Excalibur. Like, I mean, I remember us even trying to decipher on the show exactly what the order of functions is with something like this. And so I would suggest most, like, judging by the sound in the arena, it felt like most people were just assuming that this was going to be a regular battle royal with one definitive winner. I'm
not complaining. I did not want to see this end in 2 minutes with an elimination. I'm very happy we're getting this match.
I am too, but I would actually like do the match then. Like, you know, like, okay, final two, the rules become it's a match, okay? And you just like, you should do it all at one time. I think that would just create a better atmosphere and maybe a little bit less disappointment or confusion on the night of.
Throughout the month of January, you have the chance to lock in your subscription at the Post Wrestling Cafe for all of 2026 before the price increase takes effect February the 1st. Simply sign up before February 1st and you will lock in that price all year long. If that's not enough, this month we have the annual Best and Worst of Show as we get together with the Poison Rana crew to look back at 2025. We're also doing live watch-alongs of the Royal Rumbles from 1990 and 1995 with Brandon from New Jersey, a retrospective on the Tanahashi-Okada rivalry, plus reaction to Wrestle Kingdom 20, a review of TNA's debut on AMC, and much more, including TNA Genesis, UFC 324. It's all found at postwrestlingcafe.com. Jon Moxley is backstage. He likes the C2. It's simple. There's nowhere to hide. It reveals more about a person. I like to push people's buttons, and sometimes the results. I brought out a monster in Kyle O'Reilly. It's the best I've ever seen Roderick Strong. Well, when the Continental Classic is over, I won't have left any bullets in the chamber. I left it all out there.
He's already a babyface. Really.
Like, he just didn't tell us, but this was just like, this was the most babyface promo I've heard Jon Moxley cut in a year and a half.
Yeah, the turn is already essentially complete. The question now is if it'll include
who's
the
with
rest-
me?
Yeah, if it'll include the rest of the Death Riders. Well, certainly tonight in the UK, Pac was a babyface, you could argue. Claudio hasn't exactly been that heelish either lately as part of the C2.
Yuta cannot make the turn. They hate him.
They might leave him out of this. Garcia, too, maybe at this point. But I think that is the bigger question now. Of course, all of this could be a swerve, and that he might just be intentionally, you know, trying to rile us up to set us up for bigger disappointment in the future.
He's going
to
suffocate someone with a bag, isn't he?
Who knows? But I think Moxley continues to be the most compelling character, maybe on the show for me, you know, throughout these past months.
Yeah. I think there's a really interesting lesson to look. Like, I constantly watch this character in such a different way post Kyle O'Reilly feud. Like, to me, that's the most surprising, like, program that I think so over delivered from what was on that night. Felt like just a throwaway, keep Jon Moxley busy type of match. And to me, it's added such a dimension to his character that he's vulnerable to a submission ace. This guy's got his number. And I just think it's added like a certain difference to Jon Moxley. Like, he's not this protected figure that can never lose in any situation. And I think it's just added so much more interest to the Moxley character. Does that extend to the Death Riders? Maybe not. But for Moxley, I find this to be a really interesting shift that he's taken. And it really made Kyle O'Reilly. And I hope he's back as soon as this Continental Classic is over.
if you want to go like far with Moxley as a babyface, I think the move would be to have him be a solo guy, you know, with the Death Riders turning on him. Of course, you know, the question is when, and we go to, because this is a live show, we go to our super chat here from Jake from the Windy City, who actually asks, thank you, Jake, for this $5 support. He says, evening, fellas, when do you think the Death Riders may turn on Moxley, or would you not do that?
I think that there's, so the question would be, where do you go with the Death Riders post Moxley? Like, are they just in this sea of the Don Callis family, the ops, and then this makeshift Death Riders group? To me, I think there's at least a short term that you would want the Death Riders to oppose one of these teams. Like, whether it's the ops, whether it's the Don Callis family, I would at least want to get that out, get your babyface run out, and then maybe at that point, they could turn on Moxley or something. But I think there is some value in what's been the lead heel group that's not the lead heel group anymore, but you freshen them up and they get like that babyface run at the end of things.
Yeah, certainly. You know, the audience, the question is whether or not the audience will take to them. And I feel like there's a strong chance they will. I mean, you're talking about just some very talented professional wrestlers. Yuta's going to be the tough one. Okay. I don't know if they'll take to Yuta as a babyface again. But like when it comes to Claudio, when it comes to Pac, I think when it comes to Marina, like this, they will get the crowd to cheer for them if they want the crowd to cheer.
Yuta and Garcia are tough right now. Like you've just turned Garcia.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like a clean shift as opposed to if it was just like the core group members before. Well, Yuta's a core member, but
the time you want to really like have this sort of faction intact is like heading towards Anarchy in the Arena. Well, Blood and Guts, like they kind of push, you know, later in the calendar, so that's not as big.
They can come up with a reason to have a bloody showdown.
Yeah. Can they hold off for that long though? You know, can they run with them potentially as a babyface group for that long? Or is the big money in John Moxley as a singles guy babyface right now?
Orange Cassidy, Máscara Dorada in the Blue League, each with 3 points. They did like a lot of like technical wrestling in the early portion, and then Orange kind of picks up the pace, putting the hands in the pockets. Dorada posted off a satellite DDT attempt, but then Cassidy followed, hitting it. And with Cassidy working with a bad back, he can't go for the beach break, but Dorada hits him with this big backbreaker. Orange punch gets avoided, and then Dorada tries for a tornillo off the top. This wasn't quite smooth, going into an arm drag, and then he tries for like a cradle, but Orange Cassidy counters it with a crucifix, catching Dorada in 11 minutes and 12 seconds, and Cassidy moves to 6 points. He is now tied with John Moxley in the Blue League.
I really like this match, in particular, like the style of match that they chose to have. I mean,
very different from anything else on the show.
Yeah, well,
that's what Dorada brings to like his types of, you know, matches in this tournament.
But in this match in particular, I mean, they worked it just, it's a technical match, you know, very different from the rest of the Continental Classic. And I think like it was a great showcase of both of their technical ability. I mean, I've been watching Orange Cassidy at this point, like every week for like, what, 6 years or something. And I continue to just be so impressed by him as a pro wrestler. His consistency and his versatility are incredible. And I think that's often overshadowed by his gimmick. But as a pure pro wrestler, I think he's outstanding. And they mentioned Dorado's only 4 years in.
Yeah.
That can't be right. That's amazing.
Yeah.
He only
got the gimmick like 2 years ago. Like he's like, this guy is like the next coming in CMLL. Like he's kind of already there, but yeah, this
Holy
guy is
4 years.
If he stays healthy, this guy's going to be like, you know, this guy, I don't know if he'll be a mystical level, but man, he's on the pathway for sure.
So at the end of this match, Cassidy throws his glasses to Dorada. And Dorada, I don't know if he got them out or not, but he has no ears, so he can't put the glasses on.
Yeah, so it was symbolic. It wasn't meant to literally be utilized.
He tried to just gave up and just like rolled out of the ring.
No, that's I hope the next tournament match he comes out wearing these. Somehow.
Yeah.
Somehow. Lexi Nair spoke to Monet and Athena. That's where they issue the challenge, and it is made for World's End. Plus, Mercedes will defend the British women's title on Collision on Saturday.
Might
do we state the
watch.
Opponent, or do we avoid that?
Do we state it?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, you're saying that, so... I never know how these how folks are going to react. I feel it's somewhat like, newsworthy, but
it's Alex Windsor, okay? Like, so what? Like, right. That should make you more excited to watch the match. I don't think that Like, are people going to complain?
This is like Saturday afternoon. God knows if people are even going to find this show. But there you go. That's coming up on Saturday. Jamie Hayter and Isla Dawn. Dawn took like 80% of this. She was just like in control for most of it. And then Hayter pops off the shoulders. And then she goes for the Haterade. And Isla's like blocking it. And then Hayter like just like deadlifts her up to hit this Haterade, and it is the ugliest Haterade you've ever seen, to the point that she just lifts her up to hit a second one and pins her in 6:46.
I don't think it was meant to be the Haterade. I think that was supposed to be the Hate Breaker, which is her backbreaker. They screwed it up the first time. The second time, I don't know what happened, but because like Dawn ended up landing on her back to the mat, and like Hayter's leg looked to be
You're right. I'm confused on my Hayter's maneuvers. These are you're
that
right.
That was a bit weird.
It was very clunky, and she just it looked like she just called on like that looked terrible. Let's do it again. But they shook hands afterwards. Jamie Hayter gets the win. Setting up, going into the women's title match at the pay-per-view. She gets jumped by the Sisters of Sin. Tekla is whipping her with a belt when Statlander runs out, and they run wild on Blue and Hart. I could potentially see, some kind of match with the Sisters of Sin at the New York tapings, but I don't see them bringing Isla Dawn over for those tapings, you would think. And then it ends. Statlander double suplexes Blue and Hart, Tombstone to Sky Blue, and then Jamie Hayter misses and nails Chris Statlander by mistake with the Haterade, but doesn't really care and lifts up the belt.
Mm-hmm.
That should be most people's reaction. I think people way overreact when they hit someone.
Yeah, of course. You know, it's a contact sport after all.
That's what happens.
I thought Hayter brought like a side of Dawn out that we certainly didn't see too often in the WWE. This was a much more hard hitting match than we've seen from her pretty much throughout her entire stay there.
Didn't see Dark, but she got like a lot of like compliments for her match on the Cardiff Wales show. And I'm wondering if that performance got her booked on this show, because it was right after that they announced her and Hayter for the show. So she's at the very least on their radar.
Sure, yeah. Like, good enough to be signed? I mean, I think that's a bigger question, because I think airtime is always a struggle for the women in AEW. And, I mean, you kind of have to show something really, really strong in order for perhaps to, you know, get the audience to even clamor for your appearance. But, yeah, like, Statlander and Hayter, I feel is a feud that certainly needs a little bit more heat attached to it. And I hope this was a sign of Hayter leaning more towards playing a heel, because I think it needs that sort of element to just kind of, you know, get a bit more attention. Like, the Statlander run so far is it's been okay, but like it's certainly losing a little bit of steam for me. And she's had some time really to kind of find herself, and I feel like
she's still looking.
She's still looking, and I don't know how much more patience the audience might have. But again, the saving grace, I think, will always be in ring. I hope these two, they have the potential. I hope they manage to, you know, deliver something that might even steal the show at World's End.
And then to cap off the show, it is FTR against the Bang Bang Gang for the AEW tag titles. FTR had the heat on Austin. They build up to Juice's tag. He's in there inside cradle on Dax for a big two count to counter a vertical suplex. Stokely got onto the apron and he had powder in his hands, but is stopped by Juice, and then gets the attack is thwarted. It's Juice and Austin who end up hitting the Power and Glory onto Dax, and Cash tries to break it up, jumps off the top of the splash, but misses and lands on his partner. Austin then misses Cash on the floor, and man, did he just crash into this timekeeper's area. You thought he was dead, but then as they're setting up for the shatter machine on Juice, Austin comes back to life and removes Cash by posting or crotching him on the post. So Dax has no one to complete the shatter machine for. There's a famouser. Juice gets on for the cover, but then Cash returns, getting the foot on the rope and breaking it up. Turner's hand hits the mat three times, but there was no Thea Hale incident here. It's close, though.
No.
Crowd chants bullshit at this, and then they put Juice into a figure four with Cash stomping him, coming off the turnbuckle to his previously injured knee, and Dax puts on an inverted figure four, and the belts are laying there, and Juice is trying to reach for the belt, but he has to, on the inside, smile and tap, and he gives up at 14 minutes and 34 seconds. I really like this ending. Instead of just doing your, you know, shatter machine finish with like interference, it was like they focused on the knee. They gave Dak something different to win with. Good match. I wouldn't say that this, like, I don't think this reached, like, you know, pay-per-view level of what you would expect. The promos are really good leading up to this. This was very late in the show, but it was still like a fine tag match. I didn't have that many complaints about it, but it was not of the level of like some of, you know, Juice and Jay White's matches with FTR. If you were going to set that as your standard, this was not that.
Well, I didn't even think it was at the level of some of their collision matches as Juice and Austin.
That's a good point. Yeah, I think the collision match was ahead of this one where they did the upset.
But I mean, I also feel like my energy was relatively low to start for this one. And I mean, I wonder, like, this deep into what a 3-hour show, how much that might have affected the crowd's energy as well. But they closed it really strong with the near falls. I mean, I thought it was a really great finish. Yep. In particular, the last one with Dax's foot on the ropes.
And they were into Juice. Like, they were singing for him and stuff. So, I mean, I felt the crowd, they were, you know, it wasn't to the extent of, like, earlier, but I felt they were still with this one. And the one saving grace way was it was there were like 9 minutes left and then it finished. And I was like, oh, this is not the, we are not on the live feed. So we got the underrun. I was like, okay, I can live with the underrun for this. So
I wonder what they did on the broadcast. What
I think we just probably were spared some commercial inventory, probably. There was no way they were ending it that early, I'm sure, on TBS. But there you go. That was the show. I thought this was a really excellent show. I'm not going to complain about like the 3-hour shows. I certainly do not need these regularly, but and this was an extra hour. I basically spent, I sat down here at like 8:15 and was like, I've got to now wait 45 minutes for this show to start. So it was bugging way via text, figuring things out, and then learning some Spanish as well in the opening match. But we got here to the end. There was some really excellent wrestling on this show. I mean, for that trios match was maybe the match of the show, and I think you can make a strong argument that Pac and Fletcher, they had an amazing match. Mm-hmm. I thought that the Orange Cassidy Dorada match was a lot of fun. Yeah. I really enjoyed Moxley and Strong as well. And I thought that the promo segment with MJF was great. So there was a lot of really strong stuff on this show. I would not say that this is one of those shows that, oh, you could have done this all in 2 hours. I think the show kind of did need the 3-hour format for all that they had planned on this show.
Agreed. And again, I think the Continental Classic just like really does wonders, especially for a collision. You know, usually like,
sure,
you know, like at the point of either the long taping or like the point in the week where, you know, Tony tends to just kind of throw a lot of matches that aren't really like the most interesting or relevant, like having anything attached to the Continental Classic immediately raises the stakes and makes it a must-see match, especially at the quality level that these matches tend to be. And I thought tonight continued to carry that through. You got an incredible Elite match that, again, kind of gave me the warm and fuzzy seeing Kenny and the Bucks team together. And you got a big return here in MJF.
So Saturday's Collision, again, it's only a 4-match show because it's an hour at 2:30 Eastern, which is live coast to coast. So that means
it's only 1 hour. So they basically split the hours.
I think that's the deal. Right? Yeah. Okay. So this is airing on the West Coast at 11:30 a.m. on Saturday. In the Gold League, it's Mike Bailey against Jack Perry. In the also in the Gold League, Okada and Kevin Knight that they announced, Mercedes and Alex Windsor for the British women's title, and then Eddie Kingston against Nathan Cruz, who was also on Dark in Cardiff as well. So that's your show, and that was all taped on. So you had basically a 4-hour taping on, well, minus commercials, so they probably got it in.
And Mercedes working double duty.
That's right. Yeah. She had both matches as well. So there you go. The workhorse of the Manchester tapings. We are going to forgo feedback tonight because it's past 1 a.m. here on the East Coast. I'm going to venture to guess that Wei Ting, in addition to all of his regular duties he has after we finish recording, how many rounds into the draft are you? How many picks in have you witnessed?
I don't need to answer that.
Okay. Well, he always makes it somehow. God knows how he does this, but he will be with us on Thursday to chat the draft from March of 2002. They've got to get some of these old Raws up onto Netflix because, man.
How do you recommend people find this one?
Oh, Jesus. It's on Daily Motion, but okay. God, do I hate that service. I hate Daily Motion. I downloaded some ad blocker and it did something to my system, and I'm just, I don't know what I'm doing. Way, you need to just rescue me.
Let that be part of the experience, I suppose. Maybe send your messages to Netflix to get them to get that up there. But yeah, this is, again, for many people that might be listening to our free edition, just a bit of a sampling of the XL editions that we usually do after every single Monday, Wednesday, Friday, covering these shows. News chat that actually didn't really wasn't all that truncated.
No,
today,
I always say
that's okay. That's totally fine.
I've got to get your opinions. Well, I need to hear your thoughts.
And then after these shows, we usually do feedback from our Post Wrestling Cafe audience. So that's not necessarily today, but on Friday, we'll certainly be back with all of that.
Yes. Regular time and format on Friday for Rewind to SmackDown. So all of that is coming up this weekend. Plus, the NWA podcast will be live on a Sunday night with Nate Milton and company with their Christmas special. And I'll make one last note that the jingle contest, the deadline is Monday, December the 22nd. Submit all your jingles by noon Eastern on Monday. You can submit them at forum.postwrestling.com. You can post them in the thread or send them directly to me, john@postwrestling.com. We don't have too many guidelines, but we do have some suggestions for there. Post them up by Monday. They will all be played on the Post Wrestling Christmas show, and we will crown a winner. All right, that's it for us. Thanks to everyone for staying up late with us for Rewind to Dynamite.
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Studies show that 100% of everybody in the world wants to curl up indoors and do nothing because it's so darn cold out there. That's why many people are turning to Bombas, whose pillowy plush slippers and warm merino wool socks have been said to be the most comfortable in the history of feet. Bombas products have been found to boost coziness by up to 1,000,000%. Okay, enough fake statistics, but could Bombas socks and slippers really be the cure? Go to bombas.com/audio and use code AUDIO for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com and use code AUDIO.